delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with government officials and the ambassadors of Muslim countries. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Husseini on March 31, 2025. Today, events around the world are taking place in rapid succession at a staggering pace, whether in our region or in other parts of the world. This rapid pace at which events are taking place necessitates that all those who see themselves as being either influential or affected by these global events keep up with these events quickly and carefully and state their position. Today, Islamic governments have this duty. Islamic governments should think carefully about their own nations, their friends, their enemies, and the events that lie ahead and await them. The Islamic world is quite large. We Muslims have a large population. We are situated in a critical geographical location in the world. And, in terms of the world's natural wealth, we rank among the wealthiest countries and communities in the world. If the Islamic world wants to take advantage of these critical situations, it needs to take a fundamental action: unity. The unity of the Islamic world. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Unity doesn't mean that governments should merge together into a single entity. It doesn't imply that they must think alike in all political orientations. The unity of the Islamic world involves, first and foremost, recognizing common interests. And the first step, they need to know what their common interests are. We shouldn't define our interests in a way that would lead to discord, conflict, and strife among ourselves. The Islamic world is one family. It's one whole. Islamic governments must think about this and move in this direction. The Islamic Republic has extended its hand toward all Islamic governments and considers itself to be their brother. As the president just stated, it considers itself to be with them in one general fundamental front. Let's work together and put our minds together. Let's maintain unity in the Islamic world. If we do this, the aggressive, oppressive, coercive powers won't be able to attack the Islamic world, impose their will, or blackmail them. Unfortunately, extortion and blackmail have become the common practices of the powers today. Major powers blackmail weaker countries, governments, and nations, and they state this openly. Let's not allow the Islamic world to be blackmailed by the US and the likes of them. We must defend the rights of the oppressed. Today, part of the Islamic world is severely wounded. Palestine is wounded. Lebanon is wounded.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IB English Radio.
Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brother, dear sister, salam, and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. Today's message is simple, yet its impact is life-changing. One act of kindness can echo into eternity. Imam Hussain alayhi salam, the man who gave everything he had to save faith, truth, and dignity, teaches us, whoever relieves a believer's distress, Allah will relieve them of the distresses of this world and the hereafter. Let that sit in your heart for a moment. You don't need to be rich. You don't need to be powerful. Just need to be present and compassionate. Think about the last time you were in distress, mentally, financially, emotionally. Now, imagine someone stepped in quietly and helped you. No show, no judgment, just love. That's exactly the kind of action Imam Hussain alayhi salam is calling us to. And it's not just talking about charity, it's talking about emotional support, listening to someone cry, easing someone's burden, or just sitting beside them in their darkest hour. In a world that often tells us to mind your own business, Islam says, make their pain your business. And modern science supports this teaching in powerful ways. Research in psychology shows that helping others doesn't just benefit the receiver, it transforms the helper too. Studies show that people who regularly engage in acts of kindness have lower stress, improved mental health, longer life expectancy, and even greater happiness than those focused only on themselves. Why? Because we were created to connect. We were wired to care. And when we relieve someone's suffering, we align with our truest, most spiritual nature. Imam Hussain alayhi salam didn't just say these words, he lived them. On the day of Ashura, surrounded by enemies, he still offered water to the thirsty. So here is your call to action today. Is there someone carrying a burden you could lift, even a little? Someone going through anxiety, grief, or financial strain? Someone who just needs a message that says, I'm here for you? So even a single kind word, a gentle smile, or sincere prayer can count as relieving the stress, the thing that Imam Hussain alayhi salam tells in this hadith. And the reward, Allah will lift your burdens, not just in this life, but when you'll need it the most in the hereafter. So be a light in someone's darkness, and when your own world gets heavy, trust that God is watching. He never lets an act of compassion go unanswered. And until next time, stay kind, stay awake, and be the reason someone breathes easier today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,710 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. On FM, 91.5 megahertz for Iran. You can also listen to the English channel of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. You can also listen to the radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our radio quality and other means.
Good night to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio. Greetings from Tehran. Very nice to have you with us. I invite you to listen to some interesting facts about Islam. Islam does not have an ordained clergy or representatives of a church hierarchy in the way that Christianity does. However, every mosque has an imam, or the one who stands in front to prayer and deliver the sermon. Jesus is an important figure in the Holy Quran. Like Christians, Muslims believe in the virginal conception of Jesus by God's Spirit. However, Muslims do not believe Jesus is the Son of God. For Muslims, the concept of the Holy Trinity represents a form of polytheism and the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with the Spotlight, a program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. After that, we have Viewpoints. The program presents an analytical roundtable discussion of various political and social issues of the Islamic world today. And our final program this hour is our Varied Radio Productions feature.
The Spotlight.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And while the Israeli regime has been successful in its many years of occupation and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people and their homeland behind U.S. and European political and military cover, there are emerging dynamics now challenging the status quo. Ongoing Gaza genocide has impelled more and more states, organizations, and bodies to find ways to restrain Tel Aviv's barbarism against Palestinians and its reckless adventurism throughout West Asia. From the ICC this week refusing to revoke arrest warrants for Israeli leadership, to an Irish boycott bill of Israeli settler products, dubbed the Occupied Territories Bill, and Slovenia barring two Israeli ministers in the current cabinet from ever visiting the country. And these small but highly significant mechanisms of restraint, and a few more, the focus of today's Spotlight program. And now for our guests. Joining us, Mr. Paul Lurie, co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement, joining us from Berkeley, California, in the States. And Mr. Sayed Wilson Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. Gentlemen.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Pleasure to have you both join us on the program. I think this is the first time I have Paul, both you and Sayed, at the same time. It's a pleasure. Hope both of you are doing well in your respective neighborhoods there. I guess, Paul, we'll start with you. It's been a while since I've checked in with you. Hope you're doing well in Northern California. When we see the U.S. And most European countries showing no sense of urgency in addressing the Gaza genocide, Paul, how important is it that these other balls start rolling?
What do you mean, no sense of urgency? The United States is urgently sending all the weapons and taking them from Ukraine to Israel. They urgently want to support the genocide in Gaza by every means necessary. I call that urgent. I think you meant something else,
but basically these small movements and avenues of restraint, how significant do you see them being? We know that they don't stand up to U.S. vetoes. We know they don't stand up to all the lobbying in Europe and also in the States. But there has to be some silver lining. What is it?
Well, as you know, the United States Congress is in the complete control, at least on this issue and actually on several other issues as well. By the Israel lobby, AIPAC, but it's also other organizations that have a stranglehold on our more than just the Congress, actually. It's a great part of government. So the people, there have been efforts by groups in the United States and individuals, massive numbers of individuals have individually written to members of Congress and the government and demonstrated and written articles, and it's been the subject of social media and all this sort of thing. It's very clear that the majority of the American public, despite all the propaganda to the contrary, is opposed to this war. But the government goes ahead because the government knows that if someone who is opposed to the genocide in Gaza gets into an official role in the U.S. government, the lobby, Zionist lobby will destroy them and take them out and find somebody to replace them. So this is the problem that we face. In the United States, I would have to say the efforts are worth doing, but they're not as effective as the efforts that you cited that are taking place in other countries.
All right, fair enough. Thank you for your initial thoughts, sir. Paul Sayed, Mohsen Abbas, welcome. Thank you for your patience and your initial take, please, as well, on these growing mechanisms of restraint, say it, and how significant you see them, if at all effective, in further ostracizing Israel.
Well, first of all, I think it's a miracle that we've got to the stage where finally, after 2 years of genocide, we have nations who are beginning to speak up about very basic issues. And I think the kind of things that I picked up were, pledging to cut the military ties, the idea of also putting sanctions, some sort of economic sanctions, trade, cutting diplomatic ties. These are all things actually which the UN rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, was very, very keen on. And she also pointed to the EU particularly failing from her point of view, because they have doubled the size of trade relations with Israel. They actually are their top trading partner, as it were. And that, simply the fact that they even, the EU even, are even beginning to talk about some kind of suspension of economic ties, it's a miracle, and it's not really enough, of course. She's saying, well, suspend the entire association agreement, which, according to international law, you're obliged to do under the circumstances. But, of course, the EU and the US and all those Zionist imperialist regimes don't really want to do any of this. It's just that now it's almost probably becoming so untenable within their own populations, who are having a meltdown about the way Zionists basically control Western governments, that it's almost becoming embarrassing for these politicians, and they've got to be seen to be doing something. The Hague Group, of course, are probably better than most, and those eight countries, there's a chance that we're going to get these embargoes going and some sort of sanctions scenario. Because as the Colombian vice minister said during the talks in Bogota, he said that what's gone on in Gaza is an affront to international order. I'd say it's an affront to civilization and humanity, frankly.
Okay, now I'm glad you brought up Bogota there, Sid. Paul, the UN Special Rapporteur on Occupied Palestine, Francesca Albanese, recently the first to be directly sanctioned for her work to address the Gaza genocide, fight for Palestinian rights by the Trump administration. She made her way down there to Bogota to attend this the Hague Group conference consisting of 12 countries. She was able to get a consensus. She had everybody calling it a genocide, which is huge. And consequently, the 12 countries agreed to bar any arms sales to Israel. What kind of victory do you see this as?
It's a victory. But I think some of the other things that they discussed, such as actually sending forcibly food into Gaza with troops that will not accept to be turned away. It was brought up, but that's probably the only thing that is going to be effective, or something like it. Basically, Israel has to feel real pain in order to desist in its crimes against Gaza and against Palestine. Otherwise, they are going to say, "We can wait it out. That's okay. We don't need trade with this country or that country, or we can manage without it. We can get everything we need from our partners, especially the United States, which will get the supplies that we need and figure a way to do this." So, it's good. It's a very good start. It's encouraging, but there have been lots of encouraging signs since October 7th, almost 2 years ago. Mm. So I don't know. I'm not holding my breath on this.
Thank you. And Sayed, the International Criminal Court said it will not revoke arrest warrants that it issued for Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, and ex-war minister there, Yoav Gallant. And also this week, a U.S. court also said the Trump administration is sanctioning the three ICC judges and their boss, chief prosecutor there, Karim Khan, who issued these warrants, that it's dead wrong, that there's no legal standing for it. How do you gauge another small victory here with respect to the ICC, Sayed?
Well, I think it's definitely, again, a step in the right direction. If the ICC or the ICJ have any credibility as international legal entities, Netanyahu and all those involved in genocide should be arrested in any country they land in, to be fair. That's the compliance that should happen. They should be handed over to the courts, and the courts should deal with them according to the evidence that's already been presented and the tons of evidence that's been accumulated since that ruling, which has been ages. Most people say the ICC, the ICJ, the UN, frankly, they've all failed. They haven't done nearly enough. They've not really participated in synchronizing any kind of real legal punishments on Israel. They've not been boycotted. They've not been banned from any international bodies. They're still members of the UN. They're still members of all of these other institutions. I mean, Russia, by comparison, was hammered very quickly, you know, sanctions and the lot, really, you know. So to be honest, it's not good enough, but something is better than nothing. What to really be happening, of course, is that Israel should be boycotted in every way, shape or form. There should be no diplomatic relations with them. And the real way forward, ultimately, has been shown by the Yemenis. And I'm hardline on this, but you go and look at Eilat Port today, and Eilat Port is now bankrupt. It's declared bankruptcy. 90%, maybe even 100% of its trade is now completely shut down. And that was because the Yemenis made it clear that nothing was going to go through the Bab el-Mandeb to Eilat Port. So Israel wasn't going to get its domestic supplies. And I think that showed how quickly, just Yemen on its own, how badly it hit Israeli trade, and the economic impact of that would have been huge had it not been for Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Jordan creating another trade route via, you know, the sea and land to continue the trade supplies which Israel needed. And, of course, the U.S. and the British, particularly the Germans as well, have been flying in weapons consignments on a regular basis, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of military items and hardware. And quite frankly, all of this, I can't see how this lifeline and this murder line, this kind of killer line, is going to be stopped, because Britain and the US are still committed to supporting Israel. And this is the crux of the issue. Everybody wants to put plasters, and we're all supposed to be really grateful that anything happens. But the reality of the matter is that Israel itself is a rogue entity. It's an illegal entity. It's a colonialist project which is occupying a land that belongs to another people, and it shouldn't exist. That's the reality of the matter. The whole world ought to not just be begging for Israel to be sanctioned with a few little arms embargoes here and there. What they should be saying is, how on earth do we sort out this rogue nation, which has nuclear weapons at its disposal, and psychopaths in control of them? I mean, how on earth does anybody sit comfortably knowing that Netanyahu and his band of psychopaths, who basically don't think genocide is anything of a problem, have nuclear weapons, and they're willing to bomb at least five or six countries at any one time around them, causing chaos and mayhem, which will potentially all affect the whole of the region. I think far stronger measures have to be taken, and the world needs to wake up, and it needs China and Russia and the big boys to get involved as well. It can't just be these kinds of nations who are sort of relatively lightweight.
Very well put there, Sayed. And Paul, how do you see, how do you gauge the ICC's defiance in standing up for the Palestinians here? And this is a U.S. judge siding with the ICC and standing bold-faced in front of the Trump administration when it comes to not reinforcing these sanctions against ICC judges.
How do I see an exercise of integrity? I see it as normal. I see it as the way it should be. And for us to consider it extraordinary to have this display of normal judicial integrity is a telling sign that we don't expect it. We don't expect integrity in our judicial system, neither the global system nor in our domestic systems either. And the same holds true for enforcement of any of the international laws, including the Genocide Convention, which, of course, the representatives of the fledgling nation of Israel were instrumental in creating, and they welcomed, and now they are the worst offenders of the Genocide Convention, and the rest of the world, under the Genocide Convention, which basically all of them signed, with some exceptions, they're not following their obligations under the Genocide Conventions to stop all support and to practice all, enforcement measures in order to prevent and stop genocide wherever it appears. What happened to all of that? It's a farce. It's clear that in today's world, if not since the beginning of time, that might makes right. And if enough nations are willing, like the Hague Group, for example, that's not, I wouldn't say they're necessarily enough, but it doesn't take a large number of nations to say, hey, let's all get together and send our armies and our cargo ships to Gaza and dare Israel to hit us. Well, yeah, if it's just one or two, and if it's and depending on who they are, it might not be effective. But if you get enough who already have shown that they are enforcing restrictions on Israeli trade and international travel and diplomacy and so forth, if you get enough of them together, it can happen. They can actually, the kinds of things that Israel is doing now to kind of coerce the United States into doing its work, such as the strike against Iran, if other nations will do just the opposite, and basically coerce the international community into doing something to defend Palestine and Gaza and international law, then it might be possible, but you have to have a critical mass to do that.
Interesting points there. Thank you, Paul. And Sayed, just this week there was quite a significant setback. European Union was on the cusp, it seemed so, very close to pushing through punitive measures against Israel, but with some heavy Zionist lobbying with the foreign minister flying in, and who knows what went beyond the scenes, they put it off. Nevertheless, Spanish Prime Minister was irate. He's calling events in Gaza genocide. Ireland is passing legislation to bar any products from the occupied West Bank from reaching Irish soil. And this is to America's chagrin, which is relatively significant, I believe. And Slovenia has declared Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bilal Smotrich, to your point, a couple of psychopaths in this super extreme far-right cabinet, Benjamin Netanyahu, whose persona non grata. We don't want to ever see you on Slovenian soil. These are what many people call baby steps. That ideal you alluded to earlier seems like we're, you know, quite a bit away. Yeah, we should be looking, how can we just flush this whole failed project down the drain? But apparently anything short of that, how do you gauge this slightly domino effect taking place in Europe?
Well, I think mostly politicians are really concerned about their own positions. And when their own public or their constituencies actually do start getting wind of the fact that all of their lies about human rights, about democracy and freedom are basically being flushed down the loo when it comes to Israel, and that it's all basically hypocrisy and lies, that actually undermines the credibility of the political system here. I was just reading a headline during this week, and it said very clearly that nobody trusts politicians in Britain. I guess politicians generally aren't trusted, but now it's pretty abysmal that actually but politicians have pretty much lost their credibility in their entirety just with their economic policies, which are destroying their own Western nations here because they're siding with neoliberal corporate companies. But add to this now this notion of this kind of vague notion that they had that the Western civilization was in some way the kind of messiah of real civilization and was trying to sort the whole world out and was the paragon of justice and paragon of freedom, and all of that is out the window. Now you've got 85-year-old women in Britain being arrested just because they have a placard saying they support a Palestine Action, a group which takes on Israeli genocidal military companies, etc., based here in Britain. So it's falling apart. The kind of whole notion and the do-gooder West is falling apart in the minds of their own population. And I think the politicians are partly scared of that because they'll potentially lose votes around that. But also, I think that what they recognize is that where Israel is taking the world is basically lawlessness. There's no regard to, if there's no regard to international law by Israel, then what stops any other nation also saying, well, I don't care about international law either? If there's no regard to attacking sovereign nations preemptively, you know, without any provocation, then what stops other nations saying, look, we're going to go in and hit other countries? What Israel is doing is it's openly setting the bar so low now that others can also join in, and it's actually inciting war around the world. And what's worse is that these politicians aren't that stupid, that if they know once Iran, for instance, has been rattled by the Israelis, and nobody expected for them to go that far, but they have. And had it gone a little further, had the Iranians not given the Israelis such a bloody nose in a short space of time, the Israelis could have provoked Iran into shutting down the Hormuz Straits, which would have meant an entire global economic meltdown, a spiraling inflation, spiraling chaos and migration around the world. And Israel really almost didn't care. It seemed like they didn't care what they were doing, and it's still not over. They still very likely will try to go for Iran again. So the world is not going to be left unaffected by what Israel's doing. And I think that's also sinking in to a lot of the politicians around the globe. And so they've got to come up with a more robust plan of how do you stop a rogue nation which is completely out of control, is nuclear armed, and has access to all of the surveillance technology which makes them able to penetrate every other nation's intelligence services, every other nation's government infrastructure. Nobody's safe. The Mossad, Unit 8200, are capable of infiltrating any one of these nations, and they can blackmail, as you've seen with the Epstein case, which is all going on. Any nation, any leader can be compromised by their surveillance mechanisms. And I think that is also scaring a lot of nations. Yes, and of course, with the backdrop of China and Russia and the Eurasian axis, alternative possibilities, of course, this is making a lot of instability.
Thank you, Sid. I want to give the same question to you, Paul. When the U.S. Calls Irish leadership about this anti-Israel bill, you very well know the financial fallout is not what's at concern here from the Irish not buying Israeli settler products. That's not the main concern, is it? It's the fear of a domino effect of precedent. And in fact, here it is. I searched it earlier. So the U.S. has voiced concerns that the bill could have unintended consequences and harm. This is a funny part here. Both Israelis and Palestinians. However, Amnesty International has urged Ireland to stay firm in its commitment to justice and pass this bill, arguing it will set a strong example for other EU member states, Paul.
I don't know how strong an example it is. It's an example for sure, but the United States, we don't have statesmen, statespersons, and people who are looking out for the United States itself. And this is true in other countries. I would say the same with respect to Britain, France, and Germany, and other countries as well, that are not paying attention to what is in their real and immediate and long-term benefit. Because, as Saif pointed out, the Israelis do not care if there is a world war, if half the world is living under a nuclear cloud, because they're thinking about only about their own survival as a Zionist Jewish nation armed to the teeth, but they don't have the means. They're not big enough to impose directly their will upon other nations and other peoples. So they rely upon this. They don't care about closing the Strait of Hormuz or any of this. All they know that they can get whatever they want whenever they want it. And for the rest of the world, the United States especially, to go along with this, understanding how far they can be led by the nose, is just absurd. And it's and we have no people with. Take our president, Donald Trump. He doesn't think in those terms. He thinks in terms of how can we impose our will today on country A or tomorrow on country B and all this sort of thing. That's all he thinks about. He thinks about his future support within the government and within the country and how he's going to he and his cronies are going to make money out of all of this, which they certainly can out of more weapons manufacturing. I think we have to think about what's in our immediate future, not our long-term future.
Always even. A pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you both for joining us on the program there. Paul Lurie, their co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement, joining us from Northern California in the States, and Saeed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joining us out of London, the United Kingdom. And this brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for joining us, and bye-bye for now.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. When we think about Ashura and the events of Karbala, we're not just remembering a historical tragedy. We're connecting to something much deeper. Every year during Muharram and Safar, we see familiar scenes, black flags hanging in the streets, people carrying alams in the different majalis, voices reciting nohes and marsiyas, and even young children dressed as the little heroes of Karbala. But What do all these things really mean? Welcome to our program, The Viewpoint, your program on IRIB English Radio. A'zama Allah ujurana wa ujurakum bi musabana bil Husayn alayhi salam. May Allah increase your rewards for and tawfiqat for mourning the martyrdom of Imam Husayn alayhi salam and his companions. I'm your humble host, Sayyid Ali, and it's an honor for us to be here today in this studio. I am joined with two dear brothers, Brother Sheikh Danish. Assalamu alaikum, dear brother.
Assalamu alaikum.
Welcome. Good to have you here again.
Thank you.
Azamallah ujurana wa ujurakum. Thank you so much for being here. And dear brother Sayyid Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, dear brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Once again, I have the privilege to be here with you.
It's
and
a pleasure.
Azamallah ujurana wa ujurakum. So, dear brother Sheikh Danish, black and green flags are common during Muharram and people carrying them. What is the symbolic meaning of the black and green flags? Sometimes like red ones I have seen. And how do these colors influence the mood and purpose of mourning rituals?
Right. So regarding the black flags that are a symbol of mourning, right, and black clothes as well, and it's a symbol that has it's a symbol that has its roots from Arabia, of course, that during those times when a person's near and dear ones would be mourned, they would lose a relative, a near or dear one would be lost, they would venerate that person, or they would have rituals for that person in that form of, by wearing black clothes. And this has been carried on during the centuries, and it has become a tradition. Mm-hmm. And the flag, of course, is a symbol of the flag bearer of Karbala, Hazrat Abu al-Fazl al-Abbas, who was the flag bearer of Karbala.
Exactly.
And he was basically in that time when two opposing armies were facing each other in battle, they would have a flag bearer. Until the time that flag bearer was holding his ground, it meant that the armies were the two armies were fighting each other. Mm-hmm. Once the flag bearer was martyred, another person would take the charge and would become the flag bearer. So a flag bearer was important in that sense.
Sure.
And so the green flags, as apparent, would symbolize the flag bearer, that is Hazrat Abu al-Fazl al-Abbas, and the concept that we are carrying the flag of the message of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Yeah.
That is, the fight against tyranny is being reflected in this age and time by these flag bearers who are carrying the flag of Abu Abdullah alayhi salam forward. And so these are some of the meanings and annotations attached to.
I guess the green flags and or the green like sort of colorful dresses or customs in general, when we see in these theatrical performance or Shabihani, which we're going to talk about soon, represent Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam and the family, the household of the Prophet in general. And the red ones stands for the enemy or the Bani Umayyad or Yazidi ones and people like that.
There is more to it, Brother Sayyid. The green flags, of course, as Sheikh mentioned, flags is to identify the side of the armies in battle. So that's why when the flag is raised from one side, we know, okay, we're fighting with that side is belongs to this set of people and another flag. So these are identifications of the different sides
like
in their battle.
Logos.
Exactly. The black is because of mourning, is because of the martyrdom of Abd al-Hussein. That's why after the martyrdom of Abd al-Hussein, many of the Shias, they moved towards wearing black clothes, putting black flags in front of their homes, identifying themselves with black to show that they're in the state of mourning, until Banu al-Abbas hijacked that entire mission of, you know, mourning and the revenge for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. The green one has also two meanings. One is that green represents Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasalam. It was the Prophet's color. It is also easy on the eye, naturally speaking. And also, green also represents revenge as well.
Yeah.
Black represents mourning. Green represents revenge. Mm-hmm. So the Shias, the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasalam, and this is not just to label ourselves to say whoever believes in Imam Ali, no. Whoever follows the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasalam, we know Even this encompasses again the Orthodox Sunni brothers. So mm-hmm. when I mean the followers of Al-Bayt, I'm being very general over
yeah,
here.
Yeah.
Everyone believes that on the arrival of the Imam of our time, and he will raise the flag for the revenge of Imam Ibn al-Hussein. That's something that is established. That's something that everybody believes.
Mm-hmm.
So the mourners of Abdul Aziz, they keep both the flags, one to say that we are mourning, the other to say that we are preparing ourselves for the great revenge from Abdul al-Hussein.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Dear Sheikh Danish, so when we walk into Taqiya and Husseiniya, these places during Muharram, it's not just a building we're entering. It feels like we step into a space filled with emotion, memory, shared faith. In history, recent history, people got killed there, martyred there by the attack of those people who cannot bear these majalis and ceremonies of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. How do Taqiyas, these Taqiyya, as we call it, Taqiyya or Husseiniya, or in some cases we've got Hassaniya, Fatimiya in different countries, go beyond being just physical spaces and places and halls and rooms, and they become powerful symbols of Shia identity? Can you talk about that?
Right. So in all the countries where the believers of Imam, the message of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, whether they be Sunnis or Shias, are existing, they hold different ceremonies for the commemoration of these events. And particularly Husseiniyas and Taqiyyas and places have been, for example, categorized as the places of commemorating Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So we see a special respect that all the believers of this message have for these places. One is that these ceremonies that are being held are directly being held because of the commemoration ceremonies that were held by the Aima Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And so we see those holding these ceremonies, those commemorating these ceremonies, those donating funds for these ceremonies as really doing the bidding of the Aima alayhi salam.
Yeah.
So this is a noble, sacred undertaking that they are doing. And more than that, so what we believe is that these ceremonies, these commemorations, they are directly being attended to by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have in different traditions and different ceremonies, that one khatib was told to go to a certain place.
Exactly.
By the order of Lady Fatima to Zahra salamullah alayha.
Exactly.
And when that famous khatib goes to that place, only a single lady, old
yes.
lady, has saved an entire year's savings to commemorate a mourning ceremony,
mm-hmm.
and only two or three ladies from the neighborhood are in attendance.
Yeah.
So the belief is that these ceremonies, even if they are held in a small place, in a small household, have a special attention by the lady Fatima to Zahra salamul alayha, by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam and the Imam al-Zaman
alayhi
salam.
It's not about quantity, it's about quality,
yes,
right?
Yes, it's not about quantity. And when these majalis, these ceremonies are held in Husseiniyas, they become a symbol of the resistance, the symbol of the message, and directly the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam have an attention and it is taking place by their auspices, by their permission.
And one of the well-known Husseiniyah to my mind is the Husseiniyah of Imam Khomeini, which Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the revolution, delivers lectures, and the whole world is waiting usually for his last points and, you know, talks.
Just to give a little bit context on the Taqiyya itself, Taqiyya. You see, Taqiyya, one of the theories is that it comes from the word Taqiyyagah or
mm-hmm.
Taqiyya, meaning that these are places where the A'imma and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, as mentioned in the Riwayat, that wherever there is majlis, there are always A'imma and the Ahlul Bayt attending that majlis. And so Taqiyya meaning that they are bracing somewhere in the corner of the majlis. So it's something that we should be very wary about. We should not take this lightly. That's number one. The second thing is that, you see, in the time of the noble prophet, peace be upon him and his progeny, masjid and the Friday prayers held a very important significance.
Sure.
Because masjid was a place of gathering, a social gathering. place
the beginning
of
Islam.
Exactly. It's a place where marriages happen. It's a place where connections between networking between the mu'mineen happened, and the Friday prayers is where the most important set of teachings of Islam, most important news, political affairs, and so on were discussed. But then after the hijacking of Islam, after the noble prophet, peace be upon him and his family, and unfortunately the ma'sumeen and the a'imma and the ahl bayt, they were hindered from entering into the masajid and taking the pulpits.
Mm.
And so therefore, especially after the martyrdom of Abdul Hussein, wherever the Ahlul Bayt saw opportunity, they took that opportunity and they took advantage of it and revived the message of Imam al-Hussein. Using the first one being the majlis of Lady Zainab in Karbala after the martyrdom, you know, the crying, the weeping, the mourning.
Yeah.
And then one of the most significant and the early ones is the Majlis of Abu Abd al-Hussein in the Syria, the Damascus itself, in nearby the palace of Yazid,
yeah,
where the Usara, the captives of Abu Abd al-Hussein were kept there. And so wherever there was opportunity, they took it. And throughout the history, because the followers of Ahlul Bayt and Ahlul Bayt were, you know, somewhat away from they were kept away from the masjid. The hukama of the time, the rulers of the time, the tyrants of the time, they did not want to give them the pulpit,
yeah,
so that, you know, somehow it will be a revolution once again against them. So this concept of Husainiyya emerged, away and separate from masjid. Although there is nothing that there is no reverence that lessens from the masjid. The masjid,
yeah,
has its own importance,
true,
its own ahkam, its own sharia, and so on. It's in its own place. Many of the masajid are Husainiyya themselves, right? But this concept of separate place of gathering for Husainiyya emerged among the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
Yeah.
This Husainiyya can be within the home,
sure,
or a specific place outside. As Sheikh Lan has mentioned, people gather in their homes. And again, this is because of the repressive rule of tyrannies along the history, whereby they would not allow social gatherings for Ahlul Bayt, so they would have it secretly in their homes.
Mm.
Even until now, we continue it,
yes,
symbolizing the time when the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam went through difficulties.
In some,
right,
of the countries right now, like the government, they don't
even until
people.
Now. That's why we,
yeah,
sometimes we need to take the context of these riwayat of, you know, the azadari. Whenever there is mourning for Abdullah, those who attend, those who cry, Jannah becomes wajib. Why?
Yeah.
It's not because just our cry or tears are so cheap. And no. It's because the time, the reviving of this message is not that easy.
It
didn't come to us at an easy cost. We should not take the Islamic Republic of Iran for granted. We should not take many of the Husainiyas for granted, because these are the results of generations of blood, generation of sacrifice, not just one, you know, overnight.
Mm.
We should not take this for granted. And so therefore, that's why Ahlul Bayt had an important, very strong extreme importance and extreme emphasis on making sure that these majalis happen in any form possible, whether it be in Husainiyya, in masjid, in homes, and so on.
Thank you so much, both of you guys. We have to wrap up this session, and let's just conclude the session by reciting one salam to Imam Hussein and his companion. Assalamu ala al-Hussein wa ala Ali ibn al-Hussein wa ala awlad al-Hussein wa ala ashab al-Hussein. May peace and blessings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala be upon Imam Hussein alayhi salam and Ali ibn al-Hussein alayhi salam and the rest of their families and companions. Till another episode, wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, except Al-Habib.
يقول هاجثة أنا